Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stop me if you've heard this one before, but a mountain climber and a fashion designer walk into a bar and wind up on a radio show. So today on the broadcast, let's call it a sideways look at the American economy, the risks we know about and the ones we don't. From American public media and in front of a lively crowd at the Belly Up Bar in Aspen, Colorado, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Nuclear Energy Institute, dedicated to promoting the safe use of nuclear energy to create economic growth and thousands of jobs, NEI.org. And by the Chartered Global Management Accountant designation, CGMA, established by the AICPA and CIMA, CGMA.org.
Friday, the 29th of June. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us for a special live audience broadcast. We are at the Belly Up. It is, I am told, the premier music club here in Aspen, along with about 150 or so of our closest friends. Maybe 200. I don't know. Depends on what the fire marshal says, I guess. This is going to be, as I said, a slightly different kind of marketplace. We're going to talk about the economy, like we always do. Of the zillions of problems the American economy faces right now, though, maybe the biggest one is the one that is least understood. I'm talking about risk, when to take it, when not to, and what to do when your best-laid plans let you down. Coming up in a little bit, Heidi Moore and John Carney for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond, way beyond this week out here in Colorado. Fashion designer Tory Burch and the risks of entrepreneurship. First, though, a guy who knows a little something about risk in the get-it-wrong-and-you-might-die kind of way. David Brashears, sitting next to me on this stage, is a filmmaker, an explorer, a mountaineer. He is right now the executive director and founder of Glacier Works. It's a nonprofit that highlights changes to Himalayan glaciers through art and science and adventure, he says. He is also, not for nothing, the first American to reach the summit of Mount Everest, not once, but twice. So like I said, risk is no stranger to him. David, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, man.
So let me see if I can do it this way. You ready? Just riffing on Michael Douglas and Wall Street. Risk is good. How about that? You like that?
Well-managed risk is good. Risk full of lots of good information and scenario planning is even better. And being here with you and the fact that our staff in Boston drives home listening to you every night has made me into a really, really cool person.
If only all my friends thought this was the best thing
I could possibly do at the Aspen Institute. So thanks, man.
Anytime. Yeah. Autograph pictures coming later.
Well, that's great.
Talk to me for a minute about how you, in your line of work, right, in the mountaineering you do, assess risk. Do you have rules?
We have Wall Street rules. We just throw caution to the wind.
I was just going to say, so they have no rules on risk.
What the heck?
Have you heard of Jamie Dimon? Do you know J.P. Morgan Chase?
Now, let's just ignore all the inputs that say what we're doing won't work and put on blinders. We call that kind of a cognitive bias to say, you know, throw out the negative information that says we won't care what we want, where we want to be, and then at the end of the day, we're just all in a bunch of smoking ashes, but we got what we wanted.
Right.
Nobody else did. But on a mountain, that's not the way it works. People don't make money off of other people's losses. People die when things don't go right. So the way we look out into our world is, first of all, to manage risk, you really need to know your world well.
Yeah.
You just need to know every little bit of it that you can. So you surround yourself with experts. You bring in all the very best information you can get your hands on. And then you say, that's the very best information we can get our hands on. But that's what we know about. Let's find out the really big stuff that could really hurt us, the stuff we don't know.
Right. Can you have collective risk management, or does that have to be individualized for it to be effective?
Oh, I think it has to be collective risk management. Lots and lots of people with lots of good information. And once you look at all of this information, you say in your scenario planning, what are the bad outcomes that will hurt us? Or kill people,
right.
And then how do we prepare? Are we ready for those outcomes, or how do we decide we're not going to go down that path because it's not manageable?
Do you know risk when you see it?
You know it when there's an avalanche coming down from the mountain. You know it when a rock this big is falling down.
Yeah, but by then it's too late, right?
Too late.
I knew we had risk when Lehman Brothers went under. Yeah. Come on.
You know what? You know you have risk when there's a lot of hubris involved. That's a fundamental big element of risk.
So you've been to Wall Street then?
Yeah. The other thing, arrogance and hubris. The other big element when you know there's risk is when there's tremendous ambition and it's not matched by experience.
Yeah, that's
and
a great, that, that's
and those
a really
are
good
big
point.
Things that we look at when people have huge ambitions for what they want to do in the mountains, and then you start looking at their ability to know what they're getting into
right.
and how to get out of difficult situations, and you realize you have no experience. You don't even know how to plan for the simplest bad scenario.
Yeah. How do you teach risk planning, right?
Well, we ask people, and I do some teaching on this, to be very open-minded and to really take in, again, this information, but also to accept the fact that fundamentally they're going to have a cognitive bias to looking to risk in certain areas, and they're going to be able probably to manage those areas, but it's the risk you don't really plan for or the stuff that you don't think enough about to know about, that's where the real harm comes from.
Once you get burned in a risky situation, you've had something go really, really bad, and I'm going to open this up to a question here in about a minute, but once you have something go bad, how hard is it to get back up on the horse?
Well, a lot went bad in 1996.
Right, the very famous Into Thin Air.
Yeah, they weren't on our expedition, but it was a fairly traumatic thing. What you do is we fundamentally got back to base camp. When something goes wrong, you do an assessment. You take it apart. And then you look at all the components and all the pieces, and you say, what were the failure points? What worked? You know, and then you really focus on what went wrong, and you go back to the table, and you come up with a better plan. And you come up also, if you have to, with a better team. But you don't go back down that path again.
Right, right. Let me open it up to a question. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
Hi, Gail Amsterdam. Even if you have experience and you throw caution to the wind, how do you deal with risk and the anxiety that always precedes it?
Oh, risk and anxiety, right? How do you deal with that?
Well, I've been at this game so long, the anxiety part
isn't there. Do you not get nervous anymore?
No.
Come on.
Because it's too tiring. Anxiety, like, takes too much energy. I need the energy for the mountain.
Well, but isn't there an adrenaline in anxiety? I mean, I had a little right before the show today. It's a live audience, you know.
Well, I had a bigger anxiety because I was going to be sitting here next to you. That's a form of risk management for me to not just flub everything. No, okay, to answer your question, okay, anxiety makes us our senses more acute and more focused. So to have a sense of fear, create a sense of anxiety, fear of failure, fear of embarrassment, fear of shame, humiliation, those things cause us to want to perform and get performance from the people around us. So, of course, wanting not to die, and the idea of dying creates some anxiety. So then we incorporate that into our outlook on the world, and it is the one I said. Yeah. Get in the best information you can find. Find people who give you more information
right.
than you can find, and then make good decisions.
Very quickly, about your current work, Glacier Works, the Himalayan glaciers, and how important glaciers are for us as a society and a people. It seems to me that your work now comes at a point when, not that we can manage the risk anymore, we are already at risk. What do you do once you've crossed that threshold into being in risky land?
You don't say the situation's hopeless, which a lot of doom and gloomers do about climate change. And then people won't take action. Here's the thing. You know, we're going to continue to put a lot more carbon in the air. The reason we study the glaciers tell us about how climate change is affecting the Tibetan Plateau.
Right.
The source of all these big rivers in Asia, which go to all those billions of people, right? And some,
right.
they're important. So if we're going to continue to put carbon into the air at the rate we are, we're going to have a warmer planet.
Yep.
So then let's look at those outcomes. What's this warmer planet going to look like? What part of it? Which outcomes do we need to worry about, and then how do we mitigate them, adapt to them, and manage that risk caused by climate change?
And get people to pay attention, right?
That's the hard part.
You bet. David Beshears, I'm a huge fan, by the way. So
thank you.
Right back at you. Thank you very much, David.
Thanks.
Yourself around so I can see it, John. No, scoot yourself this way, seriously. As I said, and as you can hopefully hear, we're at a club today, the Belly Up in Aspen, Colorado. It is a music spot mostly, but in keeping with the whole club vibe thing, a break for a little stand-up right now. Jokes about the economy being so bad.
The economy is so bad, now American Express calls and says, please leave home without it.
The economy is so bad, McDonald's is introducing the quarter ouncer.
The economy is so bad, Angelina Jolie adopted a kid from America.
The economy is bad, rapper 50 Cent changed his name to 10 Cent. Get it? It's 40 cents less. Do you get it?
Millie Jefferson right there, our director, explaining the joke. All right, so when all kidding aside, when you get right down to it, this has been a pretty good week for the economy risk-wise, both here and over in Europe, which is actually saying something, given how perilous the European situation has been. Here in Aspen today for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond, way beyond, as I said, our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore and John Carney from CNBC on the stage with me now. Hey, guys.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
Anytime. Good to have you here. So, Heidi, big news out of Europe overnight. There is, at long, long last, can we say, a plan?
There is a plan, and it turns out that we're the ones we've been waiting for. Basically, Europe decided...
Let's explain what that is.
Yes, Europe decided to have a big bank bailout, which they had resisted for a long time, and it's modeled basically on our TARP. So all we had to do was wait 4 years for history to cycle to our advantage.
John, are we done now? Can we please be finished with the European debt crisis?
No. We're done for a few days.
You are so fired. We are never having you back.
By Monday, what people are going to see is that there is a promise. But the promise to bail out the banks is based on a lot of contingencies, a lot of things that have to be agreed upon that are not yet agreed upon, like a bank supervisor. They're going to create an entirely new regulatory apparatus before they will do the bank bailout. So, I mean, we've seen how long it's taken to implement Dodd-Frank here, and we already had the regulators. They want to create entire new ones. It's not going to happen quickly, and it might not happen quick enough.
Heidi, where's the money coming from? And then once you answer that, I got to follow up.
Well, if you know, you should join the European leadership.
Because
they don't know either. There are a lot of questions about that. I mean, we're bailing out, you know, several different countries all at once, and a lot of things still have to be figured out in terms of the actual process of this. But the consensus is among experts that Europe is stretched to the limit in terms of how much more money it can give. In fact, it couldn't even bail out little Cyprus for $10 billion.
Don't the Germans have all the money in the world? Right? I mean, that's what we've been told through this whole thing, right? The Germans are going to bankstop this because they have to. John?
Well, look, the two mechanisms they have, the European Financial Stability Fund and the ESM, the European Stabilization Mechanism, are funded by the very countries they're trying to bail out with it. So the question is, you know, how much can Spain contribute to a fund that's supposed to bail out Spain? It does get shifted to Germany.
I'm sorry. That actually flew by me. Say that one more time.
So Spain contributes to the very funds that are going to be used to bail out Spanish banks. And the whole reason,
how is that possible?
It's actually not possible. Eventually, it's going to be shifted onto some of the wealthier countries, including Germany. Germany is a large economy. It's doing very well compared to its neighbors. It is nowhere near big enough to bail out all of Europe. This is like asking Rhode Island to bail out the rest of the United States. It cannot do it.
Right. Heidi, as you know and as we've talked about, Angela Merkel said last week, in essence, we, the Germans, will underwrite joint European debt over my dead body. Her actual words were, it won't happen as long as I live. Did she blink here? Has she folded?
No, Germany lost a very important soccer championship. And she lost all her leverage. So I think what they realized, I really think it was the Greek elections. The Greek elections pitched us so close to a real crisis, and we saw what could happen if Germany did not ease up a little bit on its demands for austerity.
I want to go the other way. I actually don't think they blinked at all. I think Angela Merkel is looking at this as the opportunity to get what she's wanted, which is more power over the budgets of all the other nations, a fiscal union. They're starting with a banking union.
That's amazingly Machiavellian of you, John.
She thinks she's putting her on the road. Yes. No, I think that she looks at this as, yes, finally, this is going to put Germany in charge of the rest of Europe.
Wow. All right. Very quickly, what does this mean for us? Are we a little bit less risky today than we were yesterday because Europe is at least partially fixed, Heidi?
Well, it doesn't. It helps us in the short term, but I'm sure all of you, by going to sessions, have heard some of the comparisons.
At the Aspen Ideas Festival, we should say. I mean, that's why we're in town.
Exactly. Yeah. Have heard some of the comparisons, like the U.S. is the cleanest shirt in a dirty laundry basket, or that we're the warmest corpse in the morgue, or things like that.
The prettiest horse in the glue factory.
Prettiest horse in the glue factory. Isn't that one great?
Yeah.
Another favorite. Yeah. So, you know, we really are all in this together. It helps us for the short term, but we have to watch them.
All right. Let's go to the floor here for questions. Yes, sir.
My name is Steve Smith. The intention of the bank bailout was to not only strengthen the bank's balance sheets, but also to help businesses recover. From what I have seen, the vast majority of the lending has gone to the lowest risk company and ventures who least need the loans. Do you see this changing, or can the government force anything to do?
Heidi, talk to me.
Well, I think you have to go all the way back. Forget about banks. Forget about the financial system. Go all the way back to the times of grain and barter, right? What was credit based on? The nature of credit is that you lend money to people that you trust. And now we have expanded that to billions of people all over the world that are allegedly trustworthy of being lent hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's an unsustainable system. It's correcting itself to some extent. But you're right in the implication of your question, which is that the banks are working to their own self-advantage. They don't really know who is credit worthy, and so they'll only take the people at the very top because they think that's the answer, not to do the work.
John, really quickly as a follow-up, talk to me for a second about the appetite for risk in the American financial sector now. Just to keep
it's very, very low, and it's going to decline because our financial regulations are ordering them to take less risk. We all say we don't want the banks taking this crazy risk. J.P. Morgan loses money. Everybody freaks out. That risk appetite is declining.
But by the same token, we need lending in this economy, right?
We do need lending, and we may actually be – we have to be very careful about the way we reform our banking system because we need more lending than we're getting right now, and all the new capital reforms that are kicking in may actually hinder their ability to
lend. All right, John Carney from CNBC, Heidi Moore, she's our New York Bureau Chief. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you.
I'm so broke, my hybrid is just running and walking. I'm so broke, I can't afford NPR.
Oh,
I'm so broke, I drink 1 week old scotch. I'm so broke, I have to ski in Denver. Oh, God, you know what I'm talking about, Aspen.
Oh, snap. That was a guy who actually makes his living doing stand-up. His name is Mike Costa. He's out of Los Angeles. Coming up, risk and reward in Ready to Wear, a chat with designer Tory Burch. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, look, the happy music. It's because the world feels a little bit less risky now that the Europeans do seem to have a plan. The Dow Industrials leapt 277 points today, 2.2%, closed at 12,880. The Nasdaq up 85 points, 3%, finished at 2935. The S&P 500 gained 33 points, 2.5%, ended things at 1362. Other measures of risk fell today as well. Investors were a tad more confident that Italy's not going to default on its government debt. Yield on 10-year Italian bonds fell back below 6%. Spanish bond yields ended the day closer to 6% than the dreaded 7% level. All of this matters when you consider the American 10-year T-note. It's about 1.5% right now. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for May. Want to take a ride? It's World UFO Day. Maybe you'll get lucky. And happy birthday to comedian Larry David. He'll be 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've got a live audience here at the Belly Up Club in Aspen, Colorado with us today. So that's one different thing we're doing, 250 of our closest friends. The second different thing is no news spots, no feature stories. Instead, the economy sideways, we like to say. A couple of conversations about risk, how to calculate it, how to handle it, and how to thrive despite it. Fashion designer Tory Burch, next to me on the stage right here, has some experience with all three of those. She started her line 8 years ago, right, in your apartment in Manhattan. Today there are 73 Tory Burch stores in the United States, around the world. So one could fairly say risk, ha, right? Come on. First of all, welcome to the Belly Up.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I want to talk about risk and speed, right? Let me reach over and just adjust this microphone
Thank
a little
you.
Bit.
I'm trying Let me to
talk.
Do
yeah,
that.
Don't touch the mic. That's the engineers do that. Risk and speed. 8 years. A global company. Talk to me about the terror involved with that speed.
Yeah, so I think I'm terrified every day. And when people say, oh, do you feel your success? To me, we're just beginning. And I think after 8 years, I feel like that day in and day out. I think every store we open is a risk, and we try to do the best we can to learn the market and what we're getting into and learn to see if our customers there.
Not to get all technical, but marginal risk declines the more stores you have, right? Store one was incredibly risky. Store 74 is going to be meh.
I don't look at it that way. I think 74 is a risk as well. Every single one of our stores is performing and is doing what it needs to do. And if it wasn't, then we would quickly fix that. But to me, it's a risk no matter what.
There are 40 plus or minus in the States, right?
And about 48 in the States.
Okay, and 30-something overseas, right? 25, 30?
That's right.
Okay. As you expand internationally, how do you handle risk of expansion in entrepreneurship in places that can be tricky, right? I mean, you're in Singapore, I think, now is a new store, and lots of places in Asia. How do you do that?
We just opened on Orchard Road in Singapore, and I think
if you happen to be there, so,
if you happen to be, I don't know what that means, but we try to be very cautious about the people there, about their customs and traditions, and we also see who's shopping our line, and we do a lot of that by looking at who's shopping on our e-commerce business, and we move in slowly. I never want to open with a big bash, and we do it in a subtle way. And I
really,
think
you don't do one of those big parties at the stores.
We do eventually, and I visit at every store eventually, but for me it's better to be a little more subtle and get in there and hopefully let the collection speak for itself.
What's the moment of maximum peril for you in opening a new store, in that decision process?
It's all about instinct and gut, and I think no matter what, we're a patient brand and we wait for the right position, and it is about adjacencies and who we're sitting next to, but we think about will women respond to it, and is it the right location for us in 5 years from now?
Right. And so do you have a team whose job is that for each store or each region probably, right?
We do. We have someone who runs our stores who came from Apple, so he has a very broad view of things.
And, and he does it well.
He looks at us as a very tiny company. And what he likes to do and our team likes to do is really understand the nuances of where we are and the people there.
Right. Let's give a sense of scale. I mean, the last public numbers I saw were $800 million revenue every year, right? I mean, that's not a small amount of risk that you're playing with.
Yeah, so it's about that.
It's about that, yeah. No, that's fine. I mean, you know,
it's around that, but we have a great team, a lot of employees. So
when did you know, I guess, that the risk of that first store had evaporated and you were going to make it?
In the beginning, I was thinking about that earlier, and there's so many naysayers and so much noise and so much saying, oh, this is luck, and you're so lucky, it's another season. And my parents always taught me, number one, I didn't have limitations. I grew up with three brothers, and I didn't know that things weren't possible for women and things like that. So I looked at that as sad to hear, but I just kept moving along and moving forward. And then we had certain things that seemed to take traction, and I knew in the first few years that it seemed to have longevity.
Right.
Being on Oprah Winfrey didn't hurt us on any level.
Hurts.
It really helped us build the brand.
Yeah. So when that happened, when the Oprah thing happened, what happened inside your brain and inside the company? I mean, this was a year plus or minus after you started.
It was. We were in business 8 months, and I got a call that Oprah was interested in putting us on her show for the next big thing in fashion.
Oh, my God.
And yeah,
right?
I thought one of my brothers was playing a joke. And so I honestly never thought it was real. And we ended up going on the show, and in short, the next day we had 8 million hits on our website.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right, let's go to a question in the back. Yes, sir.
Don Finley, Question on the timeline, meaning on risks. So when David talks about mountaineering, I think he's probably talking in terms of a couple seconds if a rock is getting after him to 2 days maybe on a big mountain. Whereas in your business, it goes out from a day to a week to 2 years longer. How do you see the risk in that, or how do you see it evolving as you work your business plan?
How do you judge long-term risk, right? Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I think each collection is a risk. You're only as good as your last collection.
So every fall and every spring, you go through this whole thing all over again.
At least we do 5 collections a year, and it's 11 deliveries. So each time you deliver into a store, you're judged, you're written about. With the internet, it's instant, and so it's a whole new world we're learning.
There's a difference between risk and criticism, right? Fashion critics and writers and all that stuff, right? I mean, there's the sales thing, and then there's the vibe thing.
If that makes any sense. At the end of the day, it's really about the sales. You want the critics to love it, and that's great if they do. They don't always love it, and I don't know that at the end of, that it really affects the bottom line.
Right. What's next for Tory Burch? I mean, where do you go from here?
So we're opening more stores. We've started a foundation for
women. Actually, let's talk about that a little bit, right? It's the Tory Burch Foundation. It focuses on female entrepreneurs and microfinance, microcredit.
That's right.
Which is risk, but smaller.
So we're trying to help women in the United States and then hopefully one day abroad start small businesses and help them with mentorship as well. Launching a fragrance with Estee Lauder in a year. It'll be a first time we've never advertised before, so it'll be our first national ad campaign.
Which is risky in and of itself, right? Because as you know, half of advertising works. You just don't know which half.
And we'll see. Hopefully the perfume will work.
Tory Burch, thanks very much
for
coming on.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, offering online review monitoring and management services for businesses that know the importance of online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
So a quick final thought about risk on the way out. 11 years ago, when Marketplace offered me a job, working the overnights, hosting our morning show, I hesitated. I don't think I've actually, now that I've thought about it, told my boss about this ever, but he's out there somewhere, so now he knows. I did hesitate, though, because I had a good gig at the public radio station in San Francisco. I had, at that time, 2 little kids and no desire to get up in the middle of the night and go to work. But before I turned it down, which I almost did, I went and I asked some people what I should do, you know, to get some advice. And they said, half of them said, take it, because Marketplace only calls you once. The other half said, run away as far as you can and as fast as you can. The last guy I talked to, though, is the one who sealed the deal. And you know how the story turns out, so I'm not giving anything away here. But his one word of advice was, the biggest risk, he said, is the one you never take. So that's where we are. All right, that's Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. Today at the Belly Up in Aspen, Colorado. Today the Dow up 277 points. The NASDAQ up 85. The S&P gained 33 points. Thanks today to the folks here at the Belly Up. Mark Breslin and Jay Vatuk played the guitar for us. Thanks also to the Aspen Ideas Festival for their hospitality. Jennifer Myers and Kitty Boone in particular. Our theme music, as you've heard before, was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark, not JJ Yore anymore. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. My name is Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. Thanks for coming, you guys. And this is APM.